Thanks for listening to the Friday Live Extra from NET Radio, a weekly podcast featuring arts and humanities in Nebraska, and an online-only feature we produce in conjunction with our weekly radio show, Friday Live. I'm Genevieve Randall. Later in this week's podcast, we'll talk with participants in this year's Homerathon. But first, a different kind of marathon of sorts. Lincoln Symphony Orchestra has been on a journey to play all of Beethoven's 9 symphonies, and numbers 4 and 7 are on their concert Saturday, April 13th. Executive Director for LSO, Barbara Zock, and Music Director, Ed Palachik, have joined me in the studio this week to talk about the concert and this Beethoven journey. Glad to have you both on the podcast this week.
It's great to be here.
Oh,
thank you.
It's great to be here.
When did this journey with all of the Beethoven symphonies start?
Well, we calculated 5 years back from his 250th birthday. And we thought, oh, everyone's going to be doing something big on the 250th year, which is 2020. And of course, we plan to, definitely. And we've already been kind of in conversations about some stuff with kids and some stuff, collaborations with the Lincoln Arts Council and different things. But we wanted to do kind of a bigger celebration. And so luckily, we were telescoping out far enough
that we were able to do
that. We were able to get it started so that we will exactly finish in 2020.
That's really cool.
In the fall of 2020. Yeah, that with the big Beethoven 9.
So that will be 9. So that answers one of my questions, which was where have we been so far? Because now we've got 4 and 7.
Right.
So
this is our third year of our cycle. And so our first year two seasons ago was number 2 and number 5. Last year we did, and I want to put them in the program order, number 8 and number 6.
Yeah.
This year, Saturday, the performance is going to be number 4 and number 7. Next year, 1 and 3, the big Eroica, and then finally the 9th.
It was an interesting conversation with him about what order, and do you pair by odds and evens? Do you pair by keys? Do you pair by, you know?
Lengths, you know, right, all that stuff. But this was Barbara's suggestion, and I love it, because I think you saw Simon Rattle do
this. This is exactly the,
Yeah, and I have seen also, I have to say, on my research and various recordings, that these pairs very often come up on recordings, 2 and 5, 6 and 8. 4 and 7. I mean, they just, I don't know why, but that I've been seeing those.
That's interesting.
Those come up.
Yeah.
It's been a real journey for me because I've always wanted to do something like this because I just, it's a musician's, let alone a conductor's, but it's a musician's dream to be able to conduct all 9 symphonies of Beethoven. And it's a real test for the orchestra. From a PR and marketing standpoint, an audience, you can't lose with Beethoven. It's just some of the greatest music, obviously, ever written. But it's a real challenge because Beethoven was one of those composers who started really in one era and was the result of an even previous era. It stuck in a current era who broke into
pioneered
the next era. And so you can see actually this development. I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a Beethoven a marathon? Or what was this? Homerathon?
Homerathon.
Yeah, you know, a Beethovenerathon. But you can really see what was in his mind from the first through the ninth.
It also would have been interesting to do 1 and 2, 3 and 4, 5 and 6, you know.
Right,
but,
right.
But we really did make artistic decisions about what would be a fulfilling experience at each concert to walk away with.
Right.
To experience different sides of him.
Right.
When I was thinking about talking with you both about this, I thought there are other, you know, sort of tours of symphonies you could do. I mean, Mozart and Haydn would be hard because there's so many, right? But Brahms, Schubert, Mendelssohn, you could do. But Beethoven, for some reason, I think for the reasons that you're saying right now, because he made such a journey through all 9 of those symphonies, it makes it just adds another level to listening to all of one composer's symphonies.
It's incredible. And probably recordings of the Beethoven symphonies outnumber any other composer. I mean, Karajan himself did 3 different recordings of the Beethoven symphonies. There's so many amazing theories about the symphonies, you know, the odd numbers versus the even numbers. Just from a kind of precursory look, the odd-numbered symphonies tend to be more popular or more programmed than the even-numbered ones.
Right.
That's partly why I do like these pairings, because they are an even and an odd that we've been doing. One and three is not.
One and three, yeah.
Oh, but six and eight were not either.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Okay, so but this is going to actually lead me to my next point. If you listen to the First Symphony, you think late Mozart, late Haydn.
Sure.
With the exception of that opening chord, which is the most bizarre thing, and I'm sure that it turned a lot of heads in Vienna when they first heard it when you start on a dominant seventh chord, you really can feel the way he is, I don't know, his psyche, his mind, his spiritual muse was guiding him from the first into the second, because they could not be more different, those two symphonies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we jump from the second into historical symphony, one of the longest at the time ever written, the magnitude of which, you know, is astonishing even in today's age, is the Eroica, number three. What comes next with four and five becomes now a little bit different, because four really harkens, you think that the Eroica is really kind of breaking more into the romantic, and four really harkens back into the classical period. Mm-hmm. So two and four, you can almost pair those and say, oh, is this where he went from in two up to four?
Uh-huh.
But you can't do it with four and five, because five was written after six.
Mm-hmm.
It was just that five was published before Symphony number six was.
Yeah.
So you'd have to go from four to six then and see what the difference is there. And then you get this break, if you use these even-numbered symphonies, into a really very classical, less classical, six, I'd say rather romantic, with a classical bent. And number eight, I don't know how to categorize number eight. It's just a bizarre symphony.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love it to death. And the pairing of the eighth with the sixth I thought was really brilliant, because the least performed, I think, of the two least performed are six and eight. Four and eight.
Four and eight, yeah.
And four probably is the one that is the least of all. I've just never seen it programmed as much as all of the others.
Have you heard the Robert Schumann quote about four?
No.
This is great. He called it a slender Greek maiden between two Norse giants. So, you know, between three and five.
Yeah.
And here's a question about Beethoven's fourth that I think we should talk about before we talk about seven a little bit. I wondered, what if the only symphony that Beethoven had written had been the fourth? Like, if we just had that, how would history have judged him just based on his fourth symphony? Now, having talked about the fact that it is probably the least programmed and played.
Well, personally, I feel that if it were just the fourth, you might get the feeling of, well, this is a composer who is in the classical era, who has some leanings toward breaking out of that classical mold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can go to some incredible examples in the works of both Haydn and Mozart. And Haydn is, I mean, he's off the charts in many ways. He's an amazing composer. But the later symphonies of both Mozart and Haydn, really, they make sense that they're setting up what Beethoven was going to take off from. They gave him his platform. They gave him his springboard to that allowed him, that he thought, I can experiment with this. I can go further with what they're doing. The humor that you find in Haydn in particular and Mozart are not as evident in Beethoven, except in certain times. And this is where eight, I think, comes in my book, because I find it more humorous than any other adjective I might be able to if I could apply that to a Beethoven symphony. Whereas seven may be, at this point in his writing and this point in his life, especially after he's experiencing the deafness and the unrequited love, as far as we know, and all, is a really very one of the most joyous and celebratory of all the symphonies. And I just want to point out one thing, that in the Seventh Symphony, We get to this second movement, which is really very, very famous. And I have to say, because in the rehearsals, one of my first comments to the orchestra, and by the way, I tried to take as closely as I can the metronome marks that Beethoven suggested. Now, some of them are impossible. I mean, they're very difficult. But I try to get us there as close as I can, so at least we'll get the spirit of what he perhaps had in mind. When you get to the second movement, it depends on how you hear this.
Sure.
Because I said, folks, to the orchestra, I said, folks, this is not a dirge.
Yeah, so for anyone listening who's not familiar, I want to go on record saying that this second movement in the Seventh Symphony is one of my favorite things.
Oh.
It is.
It's gorgeous. It's just really...
And so the rhythm that gets set up in this is the key thing. And you're talking about tempo with this. So... often in my head, I hear da, 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 di, da, bum, da, bum, da, bum. Right? So what's your tempo?
Mine is slightly faster. And I would say that your tempo is probably the usual one now that we get to hear. Uh-huh. But the one thing that you have to keep in mind, this is what I was trying to tell the orchestra, it's not a dirge. It sounds very solemn and very somber. It has a very elegant and very sophisticated feeling, a very, very kind of almost intellectual or royal feeling to it, because it is a dance. It is not a march. It's not a funeral. And people confuse it with the second movement of the Eroica, which is very, very dark. My tempo would be beam, bum, bum, beam, bum. Beam, bum, bum, beam, bum. Okay. So it has this kind of flow,
yeah,
and you can feel them
moving.
With the kind of stylized, you know, elegant dance movements that they had at the time. But it's so I don't see this, because a lot of people do look at the second movement as being very sad. It's not. The whole symphony is just one big joy after another.
Well, I think it's going to be fun to hear both of these symphonies
together,
on paired. One concert paired together. And then we have to look forward to the ninth next year, right?
2 years.
2 years. Oh, my gosh, 2 years.
Next year is 1 and 3.
Oh, okay.
In the 1920 season.
Right.
And then in 2021, in the fall of 20, we'll do the ninth.
Wow. Okay.
So this is year three, and then year four is next year. One and three.
Season 2019-2020.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I gotcha.
And then the fall of 2021, we'll do the ninth.
Then the ninth. Okay. So three and nine are left.
That's
exactly.
Correct. After this performance. That's right. That's right. It is. It is.
it's exciting.
And you know, one of the great things also that I just have to throw in here is, as a music director, I have to be cognizant of many aspects of what the responsibilities of a music director are. Along with fundraising and everything else. And one of the great things about the Beethoven symphonies are the fact that they are so marketable, and they really do tend to be audience draws, right? But they could not be better for building an orchestra, because you never reach perfection in this art, obviously. But it keeps you, it helps you to strive ever more forward and higher with it. We have done actually 4 and 7 before. Actually, I wasn't here when 4 was done. I was a guest conductor, but I have done 7 here. So numbers of them we have done, but there are some that we hadn't done before.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I've ever done 8. Maybe I did 8 here. I don't remember. I really don't. But
we'll fact check you on that.
But the idea that the fact that over 5 years we're going to be covering all 9 of the symphony, I think, is very exciting.
Now I want to point out one more thing. There is a pre-concert chat for this performance, and a timpani player.
Yep.
Will be joining us, you and I, Ed, for the pre-concert chat. We've heard so often how much attendees love meeting the members of the orchestra. So I want to hear your thoughts on that as well. It's kind of been something a little bit new. We've had Anton, your concertmaster, several times, but...
because he was featured as a soloist more than likely.
Yeah, right. But now we've been bringing some members of the orchestra out from different sections. We had...
Greg Helseth, your
principal horn player, yes, joined us the last time. So,
it's a really special thing for these musicians. You know, you imagine an orchestra, and the conductor is the one who talks about the music and gives this great vision, and he walks on stage. And I got to spend some time with a really great conductor once who said, I always remember I'm not standing in front of a group of automatons or robots. These are thoughtful musicians who've spent their lives studying this music.
They are artists
in
their own right.
And who have very valid and interesting thoughts mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And because of the hierarchy that must be in place, one person has to corral all of that and create a vision that is compelling enough at his point that it reaches to the audience and provides this cohesive experience. But it's also an orchestra that is made up of these very yes. incredible, thoughtful artists and talented. I mean, Rich, if you, my parents used to love to come and sit. They would come to dress rehearsal and they would sit behind Rich.
On stage.
It's one of their favorite things to do because you watch him and you cannot believe, you know, you think that when a musician's not playing, they're just sitting waiting. Oh, no. He is tuning for the next thing, and he puts his ear down next to it and taps it to make sure. And
mm-hmm.
he's
yep.
checking, and
yeah.
he has his shoes off, by the way. And so
I
it's
didn't know that.
Fascinating to watch just the physicality of what he's doing, let alone he has a whole array of sticks.
Yeah.
He's choosing the ones. And do you know, when we moved into the Lead Center, we had a major gift that allowed us to purchase timpani. And Rich researched, and he found these drums for us, and he said, these will make the sound that Ed loves.
And
oh,
he was
that's so nice,
right
Ed.
On. He hit the nail on the head.
And so he knows the sound that Ed likes to hear and what sticks can make that sound in that mm-hmm. moment. And so it is fascinating. And I think that that's something that our audience will also just love to hear about, because that's not something that you normally get to
right.
know a little bit more intimately.
I have to tell you that Rich Jones, our timpanist, is magnificent. I mean, he is absolutely top drawer. You don't think of it this way. One of the most critical players in the entire orchestra as a single person. That's terrible to say because there are so many critical ones.
78 of them.
Yes, so. Exactly. Right. After that big speech that you just gave, right? The thing is that Rich reinforces the bottom, the bass of the orchestra in both a sound and a rhythmic way. And the colors that you can get out of a timpani are just unbelievable if you have a great timpanist. And the reason I thought it might be good for this particular time to have him come and speak to for the pre-concert chat mm-hmm. is there are two aspects of this. Who is Beethoven's favorite composer?
Beethoven's favorite composer?
Yeah. Anybody know who Beethoven's favorite composer was?
Mm.
Okay, I'll give you a hint. At the end of Mrs. Solemnis, his great Mrs. Solemnis, he writes in the Dona Nobis Pacem, he goes, mm-hmm. no, pardon my voice. I couldn't
fine,
sing,
yeah.
I couldn't play. They gave me a stick to conduct. Dona Nobis, Nobis Pacem. And he shall reign
oh.
forever and ever.
Oh,
Handel was his hero. So it was a
okay.
direct, there has to be, of course, a direct link into the Baroque era. And so when you approach Beethoven, you should never approach a composer from an era that has followed, that has succeeded the composer. It should always be from behind. The Baroque practice of timpani playing began to change right in the classical era and a little bit later, and certainly in the Romantic era. So when I first started with Beethoven 20-some years ago here, I asked Rich if he would mind using wood instead of a padded, because the wooden stick would have been the one that would have been used back in his day. What that creates is not just
very different
a sound, yes, but you're going to get this little kind of tick-tick-tick-tick-tick-tick-tick
yeah.
along with the pitch. And this is so evident in the Fourth Symphony because Beethoven is the crazy guy that he was. He writes in pianissimo and pianissimo, soft as possible. He has the strings playing, and he has these solo measures of timpani just going, and so you hear this, and it's like this little solo for the thing. It's a very important aspect of what that is all about, because you have to know what you're doing in order to make it sound musical. And I think it's incredibly authentic for what you hear. So that's part of why I wanted to have Rich here, because you can actually focus in on what he's doing on stage during this concert.
Well, for those who get to come to the pre-concert chat for this concert, you get to meet Rich Jones as well as talk with me and Ed Polacek. I've been talking with Ed Polacek and Barbara Zuck about their continued journey for Lincoln Symphony Orchestra to play all 9 of Beethoven's symphonies. And we've been talking about their upcoming concert, which features 4 and 7 on Saturday, April 13th at the Lead Center for Performing Arts in Lincoln. Again, that pre-concert chat is at 6:45 and the concert is at 7:30. Ed and Barbara, great talking with you about Beethoven.
Thank you.
Likewise. Thanks so much.
In the second half of our podcast this week, a marathon and a Homeric poem meet in the Homerathon event hosted by the University of Nebraska-Lincoln Classics Department. Both students and the public are invited to experience the Odyssey on Thursday, April 18th, starting at 8 a.m. in the Nebraska Union on UNL's campus. There's more than the reading, too, though, and here to talk about all of that are Nicole Brady and Brooke Mott, the Homerathon directors, with Mike Lippman, who is the Homerathon advisor. Welcome to the Friday Live Extra.
Thanks.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. So the description says, the way ancient Greeks intended for it to be experienced. So I don't know anything about that. Tell me about that. What was the Greek practice with this?
The epic poems were originally an oral tradition. They probably wouldn't have been performed quite in such like a way as we're going to be doing it, but they would have been told at festivals through like a performance, through song or like rhythm, and it would have been completely oral, and there would have been a large crowd there. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to create that idea within a modern telling of it.
And what was the purpose of it originally? Is it entertainment? Is it educational?
I think it's a really good mix of both, not even just at the event, but all the planning that we've put into this. I mean, we have almost the entire department and Classics Club members working in committees, making business relationships and learning how to like lead and run these committees. But then at the event, it's people don't usually understand what classics is. And me, even being a fisheries and wildlife major and a classics major, they have no clue how those connect. But the classics has so much to offer. And you can see that with our lecturers who we brought in. And at the event, all the people that are just a part of the community or different students that come and find the event really entertaining and fun. And they're learning all about who we are on the campus.
So let's take a moment and actually meet the two of you here briefly. And Brooke, let's start with you. Tell me what your major is and what year you are. No.
I'm a fisheries and wildlife major and a classics major. Didn't plan on that, but I took an amazing class called Sparta that got me really involved in the classics. So I'm a senior, but I'm taking an extra year because those double majors. But I've been doing a lot of research in between my classics and my fisheries and wildlife. So I've just been all around on campus really enjoying it here.
And Nicole, for you.
So I am a classical languages, which is ancient Greek and Latin, and classics major. I'm a junior. I came in as a business major. I took a class, as opposed to Sparta, called Athens. And equally, I was kind of roped in.
Interesting. What roped you both in about classics?
Oh, gosh. Well, Sparta, it's this amazing way to put everything we learned into real action, where you divide the class up and kids are fighting each other for points and building their own groups and governments. And I've never seen a class like that. And I've TA'd it for the last 2 years, and every year it's one of those classes that gets us majors. Kids love it, and they love it like our athletics class as well.
So I came in, it was 2016, and I could not get into classical myth. And so I just signed up for a random ACE course called World Classical Greece. And what the class turned out to be was a class on the Athenian democracy. And it was fascinating for me because this was at the same time during the 2016 presidential election. And as a first-time voter, we were able to sit down and see these like ancient like rhetoric in the texts. We were able to sit down and watch the debates and be able to literally see the techniques and to analyze it. And it was fascinating for me. And that was kind of the hook.
So how long does it take to read the Odyssey, and how is it accomplished at this event?
It's going to be shorter than the Iliad. We always plan for 24 hours, but it's realistically a little bit shorter than that. Mm-hmm. We're planning until probably 8 a.m. to 1 a.m., 2 a.m. And so we divide up the books because there's 12 books. And we
there are 24.
24 books, sorry. And we divide them up into about 50 line sections, and people just come up and read. And in between those books, we have food and entertainment from the community and our students.
So 24 books all divided up, and you mentioned that in addition to reading, there's refreshments and some other entertainment. So what are those? What's being provided?
So for food this year, again, we're working with the mill. They have been extremely supportive. They're providing coffee throughout the day and, I believe, breakfast pastries in the morning. I think also we're going to be having donuts in the morning for breakfast. Who doesn't love a good donut?
yeah, from the Mars.
Yeah. And then for lunch, I believe we are bringing in, I think we're working with Cane's again this year. We have a partnership with Jimmy John's this year, as well as in like mid-afternoon, we're going to be bringing in Ichiban Szechuan, which is a restaurant down the Haymarket. Uh-huh. It's very, very good, authentic Chinese food. And then for dinner, we are bringing in the Parthenon, which is a traditional Greek restaurant in Lincoln. So
I was waiting to see if there was going to be Greek food.
Yeah.
At some point.
Yep.
And entertainment. What's the entertainment?
We have a mix of lectures from people on campus. There will be a few, I think, puns. Are we doing Homer After Dark this year?
Oh, yeah. We're definitely doing Homer
After. After Dark, which is when it becomes too late for the children to be there, mm-hmm. and then we do some of the naughtier parts.
Yeah, so like naughty poetry, naughty and
but authentic.
Yeah, mm-hmm. authentic. During the day, I think we're going to have a presentation on like theater and...
I think we have one of our professors doing like dice, fortune,
yeah,
fortune telling.
Dice reading.
Mm-hmm. And we are trying to get in a fun cardio dance for mm-hmm. our late night to kind of pump us up. So
I think I have to say people wouldn't maybe expect that that was something that was going to happen at a reading of the Odyssey. But
probably
maybe that's
not.
Just me. But probably not.
There's so. Always time for dance breaks.
There you go. So, Mike, I'm going to throw this one to you. In popular culture, like The Simpsons have had some fun with an episode called Homer's Odyssey, which obviously Homer Simpson, right?
Of course I know it, right.
Right. Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds used it for a song inspiration. And famously, of course, the Coen Brothers 2000 film, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou,
oh, yeah.
loosely based on the poem. What do you think it is that we relate to in the story? What applies to our modern lives?
I think, well, if nothing else, I was just arguing this with my younger brother who is reading The Wizard of Oz to my four-year-old niece. But one way or another, it's about leaving home, mm-hmm. having wacky adventures, and returning. So it's the hero's journey on its most simple form. It's Star Wars in its most simple form. It's Dorothy in her most simple form. It's I now know Moana in its most simple form, thanks to my four-year-old niece.
Right.
But it's basically the Odyssey is about you wander, you have difficult things happen to you, and then you have to go back home, and then home is not what you thought it was. So you have to readjust. We're discussing it now as part of the soldier's journey. In uh-huh. particular with our guest lectures that I guess these guys will tell you about. But we're talking about it mostly as, you know, how you explore the world in contrast to the way you were yeah. born and raised.
And I introduced you as advisor for this Homerathon. Do you want to fill in any blanks there as to what your role is?
Yeah, I teach sometimes.
yeah, yeah.
I'm also a professor in the classics department. And I teach a lot of the intro courses, but also a lot of the language courses.
So let's talk about those guests while we still have some time. Who are your guests coming this year?
Well, excitingly, we're bringing in Jonathan Shea, who uses Homer, like Achilles in the Odyssey, his book is Achilles in Vietnam. He talks about the character of a soldier and what it's like trying to return to civilian life after going through all of that, or even dealing with PTSD. And we found that that can be really prevalent for a lot of our flooding victims, which is why we're working with the 4-H Foundation, to where they grant money to a lot of the students and families in 4-H that had their farms affected.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have his colleague and an upcoming book co-author, Michael Shiner, who uses Homer to talk about how to be an ethical and effective business leader and how the roles you play and what you do really affect the people around you. So amazing. There's a wide range of what they've been able to do with the work. So.
And you're making even more ties to what we experience today in modern life. Well, I've been talking with Nicole Brady, Brooke Mott, and Mike Lippman. They're all part of this year's Homerathon, which starts at 8 a.m. in the Nebraska Union, running all day until, what did we decide, 2 a.m. probably?
2 a.m.
Okay. That's in the Nebraska Union in the Meyer Commons on the UNL campus. Thanks so much for sharing with us about this year's Homerathon.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And you all should come, every single last one of you listening to this podcast.
The Friday Live Extra is a weekly podcast from NET Radio. Production help from Dave Hughes. Our theme music is by Alexios Anest. You can learn more about people and groups involved in arts and humanities in Nebraska by listening to Friday Live, broadcast statewide each week on NET Radio, streaming audio and video online at netnebraska.org, and also available as a podcast. I'm Genevieve Randall.